From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last winter was the season of the polar vortex, frigid temperatures, and a rare case of a weather term that embedded itself in public consciousness. Now we hear it's back. Is it really? Or are temperatures plunging for the same reason they do every winter as fall moves into the next season? Can we accurately predict what kind of winter we'll be facing? This hour on Point, how cold is it going to get? You can join us on air or online. What's the weather like where you are? Do you blame the polar vortex? Or are weather broadcasters hyping a routine change of seasons? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We've got two great weather watchers with us today. Joining me now from Washington is Jason Salmonow. He's the weather editor for the Washington Post, where he blogs at Capital Weather Gang. Jason Salmonow, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Also with us from Viroqua, Wisconsin, is Eric Holthaus, meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate's Future Tense blog. Rolling Stone has called him the rebel nerd of meteorology. Well, Eric Holthaus, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Okay, first, I want to get a quick reality check from each of you. Eric, what's the temperature in Viroqua, Wisconsin this morning?
It's a nice around 10 degrees this morning. It's warmed up a little bit. I just scooped some snow off the back deck, so it's full-out winter here.
Jason, how about at the Washington Post?
Balmy upper 30s, so a far cry from what they're experiencing up in Wisconsin.
All right. I want to start, Eric, by asking you to tell our audience, which I'm sure includes many slow learners like me, what a polar vortex is.
So the polar vortex, as meteorologists refer to it, it's a permanent feature of the Earth's atmosphere. It's most notable in the stratosphere and parts of it, as we saw last winter, sometimes dip down towards the mid-latitudes, towards where people live down in the United States.
You say parts of it. So is the polar vortex a singular phenomenon, and then it can, in effect, have pieces break away from it?
In extreme cases. So last year, actually, what we saw was an elongation of the polar vortex to where it circulated most of the circulation at one point was over Canada and the United States.
So the polar vortex fell on us.
As a manner of speaking, yeah, it was shifted in this direction, and that is kind of a routine thing that happens in the winter time. The rare thing that happened last year is we just didn't get a break. Where in the past the circulation is a little bit more changeable, and last year it just kind of camped out over us.
Jason, let me ask you to describe a different thing which has come up in relation to our weather patterns currently. It's the Omega Block. Now, I'm pretty sure that's not something you get at the health food store. What exactly is it?
Sure. So Eric actually just wrote a great piece on this the other day, and it's basically it's a huge ridge of high pressure which sets up. It blocks low pressure systems or storms from affecting the area over which it resides. So, and it on a weather map, it looks like the Greek letter Omega because it has this inverted U shape over the area it's impacting. And so when you have that Omega Block in place, it persists for a long time. And it's been a persistent feature over the western United States and over western North America since basically this time last year. And it's in fact served to enhance the drought over California because the weather systems, which would normally come on shore, particularly during the wintertime, have just been diverted up and over the block and then back towards the eastern United States.
Is it related to the polar vortex, and is it related to what sort of winter we're going to have as a result?
Sure. So basically, when you have the Omega Block in place and the polar vortex breaks down, it will help funnel the cold air from the polar vortex towards the eastern United States. So as long as this pattern stays in place, we're going to continue to see this situation where we're having cold, stormy conditions in the eastern half of the U.S. and dry and mild conditions in the west. And we're seeing that right now. There are some indications that the pattern's going to break down some a little bit around Thanksgiving or just before Thanksgiving. But we've seen it break down in the past over the past year, but then it just reasserts itself. So it's been a what we call a quasi-stationary pattern in that it even when it breaks down, it tends to come back once again after, you know, a week or two.
So just to restate for clarity, for those of us in the eastern part of the country, the Omega block makes the effect of the polar vortex worse or more severe.
I'd let Eric weigh in on this as well, but I think what it does is it helps funnel the cold air in our direction. And so when the polar vortex breaks down and when we have lobes of the polar vortex breaking off, they tend to come towards the eastern U.S.
Eric, you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a better way of framing it is that this omega block helps to distort the polar vortex a little bit more, and so that the eastern United States is favored as a channel for the cold air coming down from the Arctic Circle.
All right, let's play a clip of how the news media is handling this situation. On CBS Evening News this week, anchor Scott Pelley warned of the return of the polar vortex.
Temperatures are about to drop dramatically in much of the country. It's the return of the polar vortex that brought misery a year ago. That mass of swirling cold air will dip southward this weekend, sending the mercury plunging.
So, Eric, is Scott Pelley on target? Is this the polar vortex that we suffered through last winter, or is the media hyping this because of the appeal of the term and it's really more routine phenomena?
Well, the difficult thing is that anytime you get an outbreak of Arctic air, and that's the dry, near record-setting cold air that comes routinely pretty much every winter, that's part of what, you know, days earlier was underneath the polar vortex. So it's possible to justify use of the term in that way. But when we're talking about once every 2 years or so, there's a complete breakdown of the stratospheric part of the polar vortex. And that's a much rarer phenomenon. That didn't even happen last year. It was just a distortion and somehow, that term caught on and now people are using it obviously much more frequently.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got a call from Chris in Jamestown, New York. Chris, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John, Eric, Jason. Best show on radio or TV, I got to tell you. You guys do a great job, and please relay my condolences to Tom, okay?
We will certainly do that.
Here's the situation. A few years back, there was a movie called Day After Tomorrow. The main theme in the Day After Tomorrow was because of global warming, the Gulf Stream collapsed down to the equator, no longer bringing temperate temperatures to the east coast of the United States, and then crossing the Atlantic and keeping all of Europe relatively temperate. Is that a real thing? And if so, if global warming continues to go unchecked, are we going to be seeing polar bears in Boston?
Chris, thanks so much for your call. Jason, is that a real thing?
There is there's a tiny bit of truth in that, there have been some academic studies which have shown that global warming could weaken something known as the thermohaline circulation, which helps transport warm currents towards Western Europe. If that were to weaken, then maybe some of those warm currents wouldn't be quite as strong. So that might take a little bit of an edge off the of that warm feed, and so it would potentially be a little bit colder in Europe. But whether it would trigger an ice age and you'd have the sorts of extreme outcomes that were portrayed in The Day After Tomorrow, that's entirely unrealistic. So the movie basically just took some scientific research and exaggerated
it. Took dramatic license with it.
Yeah, exactly. Blew it up out of proportion.
Eric, let me ask you about the polar vortex in a different context. Is the extreme that we experienced last winter with the polar vortex, can that reasonably be related to the ongoing discussion we're having about climate change?
Yes, I think there's a reasonable line of research coming out that ties a sort of destabilization of the polar vortex, so where it's more likely to take dips to the south, relating that to the dramatic melting of Arctic sea ice. But by no means is that a consensus kind of universal statement in science right now, but it's definitely a reasonable possibility.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the polar vortex, the Omega Block, and the art of forecasting winter weather. You can join the conversation. Do you dread the onset of winter? Welcome it. We're joined this hour by Eric Holthaus, meteorologist for Slate's Future Tense blog, and by Jason Samarow, Washington Post weather editor. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Eric Simon joins us from Baltimore. He's senior vice president at Planalytics, a weather intelligence company that advises everyone from energy companies to Walmart to Dunkin' Donuts. Eric Simon, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
To set the table for this discussion, I want to play a montage of clips from last winter when mentions of the polar vortex were so common that Huffington Post put together this piece.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex, which sounds like a weapon Mr. Freeze would use to destroy Gotham City.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
We're being hit by a polar vortex.
Eric Simon, do the companies that you advise have polar vortex on the brain?
Yes, they certainly did. We saw quite a large economic impact from the polar vortex last year. From a retail perspective, we estimated the impact at somewhere north of $5 billion, but that was probably just part of the cost because we weren't really even looking at there at things like energy, transportation, logistics. And
do they have it on the brain right now?
They do have it on the brain right now. Interesting phenomenon when it comes to weather, particularly after a bad winter. The following year, the first time we get some cold weather, some winter weather, all of the companies and businesses that are out there tend to begin thinking about it and wanting to do something about it and act on it. So that's something that we work with them on.
Jason Samenow, a question about the capacity of your line of work. Is it possible with reasonable accuracy to forecast what an entire season is going to be like, or can you really only accurately forecast the next 2 weeks or week or 3-4 days?
Right. So in terms of specifics, in terms of telling you what time it's going to rain or snow or what the specific high or low temperature will be on a given day within about 3 degrees or so accuracy, you can really only go out to maybe 5 to 7 days, maybe in some situations 7 to 10 days. Some weather patterns are more predictable than others. But once you get beyond 10 days, forecasting specifics, when a storm will hit, exactly how cold or warm it's going to be, that becomes extremely difficult. And basically, the skill or the accuracy of trying to do that is no better than taking the averages for any given location on any given day. So you may as well just, look at what your average high is or what your average low is, and you're just as likely to be right forecasting that as trying to make a specific forecast based on a model, for example. Now, having said that, in terms of seasonal prediction, is the winter going to be colder or warmer than normal? There is some modest skill in doing that. That is, our skill is slightly better than flipping a coin. But to be honest...
Only slightly, though?
Only slightly. If you look at, for example, NOAA's verifications for their winter outlooks, they're only slightly better than flipping a coin. So I think we have to be careful. We have to include qualifiers when we're using these seasonal outlooks. The science of doing seasonal outlooks is very much a young science.
Well, you mentioned the science. Eric Holdhouse, how has technology improved the capacity of your business to make even approximate forecasts of entire seasons?
Well, for one thing, we have global ocean monitoring now by satellites that didn't exist, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And those satellites do a good job of keeping track on patterns of ocean temperatures, which are the main thing that we base seasonal forecasts on. So definitely has improved a lot just in the last decade.
Eric Simon, so given the shakiness of the ability to forecast, if you're Dunkin' Donuts, if you're Walmart, how do you take that information and make sensible plans for it?
Well, those businesses, like many others, tend to focus on how this year is going to be different than last year. And Jason's point about using weather averages, weather does have a tendency to return to normal. We know what it was last year. And based on its tendency to return to normal, we can help companies understand the impact that that's going to have on sales this year out for the next 11 months. We've looked at over 10 trillion point-of-sale transactions, and we understand the relationships between weather and sales, and we can utilize that to help companies understand, you know, is demand for, you know, air conditioners, heaters, ice melt, et cetera, going to be up or down by a certain percentage in a certain market in a certain week with accuracy a little greater than 80%. And that's based on using statistical models, not long-range weather forecasting, because I absolutely agree with Jason, that's got limited utility for the near term.
Well, so is that intelligence week to week what determines how many snow shovels you can find in the aisle at Walmart?
Yeah, exactly. So they'll do some long-term planning with that information, and then when you get within the meteorological forecasting window this next 7 to 10 days, and we can see what's happening, where storms are developing, they will also tailor those plans and make some different decisions in the short term to move inventory to the right places where the weather is going to be driving consumer demand, because it is a big driver of consumer demand for a wide range of items.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Ken on the line from Ticonderoga, New York. Ken, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hey, John, Eric, Jason, Eric. I can appreciate the importance of being able to relate those, you know, potentials to, you know, retailers, businesses. But I'm thinking, what about heat? When you've got folks in the Congress saying, I'm no scientist, but that should be the end of the conversation. It should be, I'm no scientist, and I'll defer to the scientists. If you're going to, you know, use forecasting models to help businesses, why are we continuing to cut back heat for people in the woods, low income, when we can forecast and maybe increase those allocations to keep people from freezing to death in the winter?
Ken, thanks so much for calling. Eric, what about that? What do you think when you hear a politician say, I'm not a scientist and therefore I can't make a judgment or come to a conclusion about climate change?
Which Eric?
Oh, I'm sorry, Eric Holdhouse.
Sure. Well, I mean, without getting too far into the politics here, it feels kind of like a cop out. You know, like we're not asking. You don't have to be a doctor to make decisions on health policy, and you don't have to be a farmer to make decisions on farm policy. So, I strongly believe that every member of Congress has scientists ready and willing to give them advice. So it's just a matter of taking that advice at this point, I think.
All right, let's go back to the phones. I've got Samantha on the line from Charleston, South Carolina. Samantha, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks. I was saying that I was noticing, you know, back on November 1st and even before then in October, you know, in the beginning of October, it was beginning to get really cold, even here in the South. And on November 1st, we even had snow. I think it was November 1st, and it could be a little shaky there, but it was unprecedented, whatever it was. And I've looked for cold weather apparel before then, because, you know, it was necessary and it was needed. And I bought a ski cap at a gas station because it was one of the only places I found, you know, that really being stocked or, like, anything with, you know, like, anything that was, you know, good looking being stocked anywhere. And it's like stores like Old Navy and Target and, like, just the generic stores, you know, didn't have it ready or stocked. And it wasn't until today, you know, now that we're, you know, like in the 40s or 50s, that I saw actually a Target worker stocking them today, just this morning when I went in. And it's kind of like, you know, where were those things and why weren't they out? And it also doesn't seem like there's quite as much of it. So kind of confusing to me. We all knew there was going to be cold weather, right? And we certainly have the Christmas stuff out. So, you know.
Right. Samantha, great point. Thanks so much for your call. Eric Simon, are you failing Samantha and her neighbors in South Carolina?
I hope not. I don't think so. You know, not all retailers are using weather to help set their shelves just yet, but those that are, certainly, we believe, have that product and that merchandise out for consumers when they need it. That said, you know, retailers also have sort of standard calendars when they set their stores with seasonal merchandise year to year. It doesn't vary a ton from year to year all the time, but, you know, certainly the ones that are using weather intelligence have the information they need to get the products out there in advance of that consumer demand and, you know, the early cold snaps and being ready for those sorts of things.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Michael on the line from Saunderstown, Rhode Island. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you. You know, my comment is two parts. The first part is, you know, it seems over the last 5 years or so that the dramatization of our weather predicting has become somewhat ridiculous. At one point, we had major weather patterns that were being defined. You know, talking hurricanes that were defined by names, and they covered these things by name. And it seems to be now that every weather pattern, every weather event, is being given a name, which, in my opinion, is only diluting the actual information that we're getting, and not allowing actual emergency situations to be given the credit that they need. The second part of this, then, is it goes back to several comments that have been prior to mine that, you know, concerning the business of weather. And it seems, frankly, absurd to me that that our weather prediction is, to me, seemingly being driven by capitalist ideals or goals to some extent.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. Provocative points. Jason Samaro, is this hype for profit and for television ratings?
Right. So, yeah, there's obviously there's an increasing level of interest in weather events. And I think that has to do with the fact that we have more and more online sources of weather information. If you go back 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all of these online news sites, which are now covering weather. And people are really fascinated by weather. It's an experience we all share together. And I think digital media organizations have recognized that and are hiring people like Eric, like myself, to cover weather. And so our job then is to, as much as possible, generate interest in weather. And how do we do that? Well, when they're big weather events, we want to capture audience. And of course, we have to do that and be responsible at the same time. And so there's a fine line between generating excitement about weather and overhyping weather. And there have been, unfortunately, some media outlets which have gone overboard with it. And so, you know, they use headlines like cold snap to threaten millions. Whereas, you know, this is a really common cold snap. It happens all the time. It's not really threatening anyone. You just have to put on a coat. So you have to, I think some media organizations have to dial back the hype. I understand, as someone in the business, I completely understand the need to drive traffic, to get people interested, to get people to click, for television stations to get people to watch. That's the name of the game. But you have to do so responsibly. You can't cry wolf, and you have to yeah, basically do responsible journalism.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Ray is on the line from Mantua, Ohio. Ray, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Yes, a quick comment according to what you were just discussing. This morning I was watching national news, or trying to, and my local station would not transfer to them because of the snow. All morning long they reported about the snow. They didn't go to the national news channel, probably an hour late. And to me, it was totally unnecessary. It wasn't a national disaster. Also, the schools closed. And this is just the start of winter. This is Northeast Ohio. And sometimes I think they really do overblow it.
Ray, thanks so much for your call. Eric, what do you think? Eric Holthouse, that is.
Sure. I wrote a quick thing last night about the snow in Northeast Ohio, that it was a pretty intense lake effect snow band that camped out for several hours and dropped almost or over a foot of snow, including thunder snow at times. So it was a pretty interesting thing that happened there. I'm not sure if it warranted wall-to-wall coverage, but I'm sure it impacted a lot of people there in that area. So going back to Jason's point, is that weather is something that people are fascinated in, especially when it impacts you or your family, or it will change your routine. People usually want to know about it.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Peter on the line from Stamford, Connecticut. Peter, welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome. Hi, John. On Point Radio a few months ago had a program on a weather satellite that we might actually be out of that satellite. We might lose it because they're aging, and the next satellite isn't going to be launched by the U.S. until 2017. And I'm wondering, how serious is this problem? Are we going to have to look for China to get weather data? Are there other satellites? And I'm just wondering if, we're going to have forecasts that are only going to rely on weather balloons or other technology if we don't have this satellite.
Peter, thanks.
That might not be available.
Thanks so much for your call. Eric Simon, if we lose a satellite, what happens to Planalytics?
Well, if we lose a satellite, I think there are actually a lot of different sources of weather data out there, the satellites being one of them, and there are plenty of sources for that information, I think, as Jason or or Eric mentioned earlier. So, we have decades of that data databased, and don't see any real potential for significant interruption in that data flow going forward.
Eric Holthouse, I understand you broke the story recently about the hacking of NOAA's Jason.
It was Jason, yeah.
Yes, about the hacking of NOAA's computers. What's the potential consequences of that?
Sure. So in September, apparently NOAA's satellite data network was attacked, allegedly by China. That's what NOAA told Congressman Frank Wolf from Virginia, that it was, that China was behind the attack, without providing any more specifics. And
what has NOAA China said about that?
China has said the Chinese embassy basically said, let's reserve judgment here. This was the first they knew of this, and they said, basically innocent until proven guilty. They're not taking responsibility for it at this point. But in any event, NOAA had to go in and clean it up. And when they did that, they had to take some websites down, and the satellite data feed, which goes into weather models, was interrupted. So that did impact weather forecasting models for a couple days.
Is that believed to be the purpose, to interrupt NOAA's functioning, or was it to obtain information?
I don't think anyone knows the true intentions behind the people that did this. Maybe they were. You can speculate that maybe they wanted to better understand the inner workings
of
the
satellite
network. We don't know. Yeah.
Jason Samaro, stay right there. Eric Simon, thanks so much for joining us. Eric Simon, Senior Vice President at the weather intelligence company Planalytics. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about winter weather and winter weather forecasting. You can join the conversation. Put your weather forecasting skills to work for us. Will it be a cold one or not? What do you think about news that America's weather satellite network was hacked? We're joined this hour by Eric Holthouse. He's the meteorologist for Slate's Future Tense blog, and by Jason Samaraw, Washington Post weather editor. I want to start this block by playing a little Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show this week when he was joking about the pros and cons of the return to the polar vortex.
Pro, it's a phenomenon that signals a return to colder temperatures across North America. Con, or as it used to be called, the month of November. That's what happens. It gets cold, people. Sorry.
Eric Holthouse, do you appreciate weather humor?
Oh, yeah. like Jason said earlier, weather's one thing that everyone shares in common. It's something that we go through together, and sometimes the best thing to do is just laugh about it.
Do you think, by the way, that weather forecasting in popular media, that is local television and network television, which is how most people, I think, consume it, is better than it's ever been?
I think our forecasting technology is better than it's ever been. I think that the tools that forecasters have are better than they've ever been. So, I mean, I don't watch a whole lot of local TV meteorologists around here anymore, because I'm usually busy writing about it. But the tools are there.
Tools are there. You're not sure how well people are using them.
Sure.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Tom is on the line from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Tom, go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The question really is there a relationship or a cause and effect at all between the polar vortex and the Pacific current phenomenons known as El Nino and La Nina?
Tom, thanks for your call. Jason, is there?
Probably in some complex way, but I would say that they're typically more, they're not independent, but El Nino is a tropical weather pattern associated with warming of the tropical Pacific. And when you have an El Nino, you tend to have cooler than normal conditions across the southern U.S. because there's more of a jet stream across the southern U.S., which brings in moisture and cloudiness. And on the flip side, it tends to result in warmer than normal conditions across the northern U.S. So it probably has some complex chain of event type connections with a polar vortex, but I wouldn't make too strong of a linkage there. But Eric, feel free to weigh in.
Sure. There was a paper that came out earlier this year that said that trying to connect that linkage from warmer than average Atlantic temperatures contributing to Arctic sea ice melt in the northern Atlantic north of Europe, and then having that heat release from that warmer water where the ice used to be, as then making its way into the stratosphere and destabilizing the polar vortex. But again, these are very stretched out linkages that they're actually somewhat cutting edge right now as far as weather and climate interaction. So it's really difficult to say one way or another.
Let's go back to the phones. Jacob is on the line from Lafarge, Wisconsin. Jason, welcome to On Point. Jacob, sorry.
Hi, John.
Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm calling because I live here in southwestern Wisconsin, but I work up in Alaska. And the last few years, I've noticed perhaps unseasonably warm early winters in Alaska and unseasonably warm winters in general. For instance, right now in the Matanuska-Susitna valleys of Alaska, it's still 40, 50 degrees, and we haven't received our first real snow for the year, whereas here in Wisconsin, we're sitting around 10 degrees in some places with over a foot of snow. Do you think that there's a correlation between this and the shift of the polar vortex, or perhaps climate change, or just unseasonable weather patterns?
Thanks so much for your call, Jacob. Eric Holthaus, you're also in Wisconsin. I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, and I'm about 10 miles down the road from Lafarge, so we're having about the same weather right now. But what I wrote earlier this week about the Omega Block and That's what we're seeing this year, is that there's warmer than average conditions right now in Alaska. That's being shunted northwards from the tropical Pacific, and Alaska's weather is really being sent on down the line to us here in the Midwest. So it's all part of that North America-wide pattern that we're seeing right now.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bill on the line from Springfield, Illinois. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to the conversation and perusing some of the comments online, and climate change has been brought into the mix a little bit. And so what's the difference between weather and climate? And as we talk about these extreme weather events, you know, heat waves in the summertime or droughts, polar vortices in the wintertime, and these extreme cold spells, so have these extreme events increased over the long term, say, since they started keeping records in the late 1800s, decreased, stayed the same?
Bill, thanks so much for your call. Jason Samaro?
Sure. So the difference between weather and climate, a good analogy is climate is what you expect, weather is what you get. So, you know, climate refers to the average. So you smooth out all the day-to-day weather. Weather, you know, is highly variable. So you can have, you know, it could be hot one day, cold the next. In terms of climate change, unequivocal evidence that the Earth is getting warmer, that we've seen most of the warmest years on record in the last decade. This year is on track to be the warmest year on record, and we're seeing increases in warm weather extremes and decreases in cold weather extremes. We're seeing increases in heavy precipitation events. So as we're loading the atmosphere with extra heat-trapping gases, these greenhouse gases that we use to basically power our economy, the atmosphere is warming, and we're seeing that reflected in weather records. And so the probability of seeing more record warm weather is increasing while the average temperature is going up.
Jason Samaro, let me ask you one other question in the category of all politics is local. I grew up with the Washington Post. My dad worked there for 30 years, but I know the institution, like many media organizations, is very squeezed on its bottom line, and there have been cutbacks in recent years in many newspapers. Are the resources available to covering the weather at the Washington Post increasing, decreasing, or staying the same?
There have never been more resources to cover weather at the Washington Post. I've got a full-time deputy weather editor who works with me. So we've got two full-time weather people at the Washington Post. That's unprecedented. Not only that, we have environmental writers who are covering climate change. The Washington Post just hired Chris Mooney, who's one of the top environmental writers in the country, and he's covering climate change. So the Post has got weather and climate covered, I think, better than any other media organization in the world.
Well, that's some good news in the media business, and I'm glad to hear it. Jason Samaro is weather editor for the Washington Post, where he blogs at Capital Weather Gang. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate's Future Tense blog. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in a moment, we'll look at the folks who get the blues in summer and thrive in cold winters. We hear a lot about the winter blues, but what about people who love cold weather, who hate summer and count down the days to the first freeze? Joining me now from Evanston, Illinois, is my old Wall Street Journal colleague, Sue Schellenbarger. She's the work and family columnist for the Journal. Her recent column is Summer Haters Get Happy as Days Get Shorter. Sue Schellenbarger, thanks, and welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John. It's great to be with you.
Okay, who are these people who like super cold weather? Because super cold weather is super cold.
Right. They are a small, quiet minority who really welcome the shorter days, colder temperatures of winter. They hate the summer. They get agitated and depressed. About 0.7% of the population has what might be called summer seasonal affective disorder, and they get the blues in the summer.
Wait, this is a clinical condition?
It is. Some researchers disagree, but the most often cited study says that these folks actually do have a seasonal affective disorder as marked by regular, the same time every year, symptoms of depression and the blues between May and September, which is, of course, the mirror image of the folks who have that between in the winter months, November through March.
Now, is there such a thing as a frostbite fetish?
Some of the people I interviewed with this condition almost seem to have it. They love to go out and shovel snow. They vacationed in Iceland. One guy had such a hard time eating in the summer because of the heat. He would take a shower and stand in front of his refrigerator with the door open, trying to get food down just so he could be cool, sleeping with the windows open. These folks really do prefer the cold, and it is difficult for them because so much social life in the summer is outdoors in the heat.
How large a group are these people, and what can you tell us about them? Are there commonalities in where they grew up, or are they? Do they all? Is their ancestry traced to Scandinavia or something like that?
That's a very good theory. Some of them thought that might be the reason. Those I interviewed, about 0.7% of the population, and they come from all areas, although probably more so from Northern European ancestry. Researchers are just doing some studies now that are shedding light on possible causes. It could be simply the heat and humidity. For example, in India, more people experience what we know as seasonal affective disorder in the summer. The end of the summer there is marked not only by high temperatures, but by monsoons, which bring really heavy humidity. So the majority of seasonal affective disorder folks in Italy are in the summer. Others have allergies to pollen. University of Maryland researchers have found that pollen is linked to depression in people who have those sensitivities. In other cases, it might just be that you hate to sweat or you just don't like the heat, researchers say, and that's sort of the characteristics of this group.
Now, is there a flip side of people who have winter affective disorder, or is that simply a no-brainer that everyone likes summer, everyone except this small group likes summer better than winter?
There is a clinical condition known as seasonal affective disorder, winter version, and a larger group, about 5% of the population, probably suffers that between November and March, and 15% have a milder version without clinical symptoms. And those folks usually have a disruption of their circadian rhythms marked by melatonin levels not quite being in balance, or sometimes serotonin, the mood regulator in our brain, isn't in order. These folks have different symptoms. They lose energy. They want to sleep all the time. They crave carbs, and they don't want to socialize. All of these things are different every winter, predictably, like Newton's universe, every time it rolls around. This is treated by light therapy, usually, and sometimes antidepressants, much better known and more familiar to most folks.
Sue, when I was a junior in high school, my father, who was a newspaper editor at the Washington Post, went to a journalism meeting and took me to visit Northwestern as a potential college. It was February. It was absolutely freezing. And it took me about 10 seconds to say, there's no way I'm going to this college. Is that a sign that I am vulnerable to the winter version of seasonal affective disorder?
Or you could just be normal. I remember the, doing the same thing and walking along the ice-crusted shores of Lake Michigan. And, you know, it is tough to be comfortable in that kind of temperature, especially during the polar vortex. So not unless you get predictably depressed during those winter months, John, you're probably okay.
Now, do you have either one of these conditions, or do you fall in that big, fat, normal range of the spectrum?
I am affected to some extent. I love the fall. I tend to like the cool temperatures. And about 96% of the population is affected to some degree. Their mood and behavior changes with the seasons. But and that's pretty normal, part of the human condition. And I do tend to prefer the cooler temperatures. So I'm pretty happy here in the Chicago area.
Okay, so there was a little personal bias in that story there about summer haters getting happy as the winter approaches.
I got the idea as the changing of the clocks for daylight savings time approached this fall, and a couple of my friends were looking forward to the shorter days and the darkness, and I was puzzling over that, and that was what triggered it for me, and looked into the research and found some news there.
Now, take me inside the home of one of your subjects in this story. We've spent most of the hour talking about the polar vortex. So when Scott Pelley comes on to lead the evening news with the idea that the polar vortex is about to freeze much of the country, are these families that are high-fiving each other when that happens?
They feel no sadness over it whatsoever. I mean, as long as they can get out and dress against it, they're pretty happy. These folks enjoy winter fashion, for example. Some of the men I interviewed, so they love the layering up all the coats and scarves, much more variety than in the summer. They love to get out and shovel snow. One of my subjects in New York City.
I hope they're younger than 50 years old, because I have been conditioned to believe that it's not safe for guys 50 or older to go out and shovel a lot of snow.
Fortunately, this guy was in his 40s. He was pretty safe, but it's a good point. But they relish the outdoor sports. They, you know, they take ski vacations, and some of them actually become sort of the reverse snowbird pattern, and they migrate to, one woman migrates to Alaska in the summer and then returns to the continental mainland in the winter. She stays cool all the time. So these folks really do gravitate to the cold. The polar vortex would really not bother them much at all.
Sue, are your weather fashions up to date enough so that there is no cold weather that Evanston could throw at you that you would not be comfortable in?
I confess to you, I just moved back here from the West Coast. I have to do some serious shopping for those big coats and heavy boots. But other than that, I'm happy to be back in the cool temps.
Well, the technology, I think, is advanced, so, you know, you can get heated gloves and boots and be taken care of.
It's true. There are so many gadgets now, from hand warmers and, you know, great clothing. It really is easy to insulate yourself and just enjoy the snap in the air.
Sue Shellenbarger is work and family columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Sue, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, John. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, the 1976 assassination attempt on Bob Marley is the plot of a bright new novel that's getting rave reviews. We'll talk with the author, Marlon James. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.